Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated and Pete Sampson of The Athletic. Three of us are rolling old school, kind of like, I don't know, what do you guys say? Would we be NWA or more like Sugar Hill Gang, something along those lines? But yeah, three-man crew today. And we actually did have a couple of commitments after our recruiting-heavy Monday podcast. Offensive lineman Charlie Tom makes six. Long snapper Sean Kraft makes one for 2027. And we have three wide receivers, I believe, coming up with decisions, not this weekend, but on the holiday weekend. And Tim, I know you did a film review on Tom, and we touched briefly on why they wanted six in our last podcast, but I think we can, that's worth reiterating.
Yeah, as I looked at it more closely today, Tim, and we and I did my Thursday thoughts, you know, all 16 offensive linemen on scholarship this fall will have eligibility beyond this year. And then you'll have six more coming in next year. Obviously they won't have 22 offensive linemen on the roster, but to speak to what we were talking about on Monday, when you and I heard a question and thought in terms of, okay, which of these guys might fall by the wayside. I think we mentioned four guys. Those guys better pick it up because it's going to be a heavy contingent. But Tom is an interesting prospect. I can't think that I've ever seen anyone quite like him in high school, or at least how he was utilized. His old high school did a great job of moving him around and doing different things with him at tight end. He's agile enough to do some things at tight end, but he projects as a tackle. Some people said, you know, why can't he be a left tackle? Because of all the great left tackle prospects that they have on the roster. I mean, Lambert and Black and McKeel coming in and on and on. So, six, somebody's going to have to fall by the wayside. He's an interesting athlete. Boy, is a bad, bad week for Penn State recruiting. Every head-to-head battle with Notre Dame went the other way. So continuation of what happened in the Orange Bowl for the Nittany Lions.
I have a couple of things. Like, one, while you should never trust a man with two first names, I do think with the expanded scholarships, and the fact
it's hard to pronounce last name if it's phonetically, you know, you can't do that either. So
I think that offensive linemen now, we've seen at Notre Dame, have the chance to be three and outs, which was never the case 10 years ago. So I think there is sort of a new reality for offensive linemen. When you have elite guys, they may leave after 3 years. Like, could, you know, Charles Jagasa might be an interesting example of that this year. You know, so the fifth year Mike McGlinchey offensive line story may be rarer moving forward. So I think it pays to get ahead a little bit of it. And, you know, this, I'll try not to walk over this question, but like, if you're recruiting Charlie Tom to be a fourth and fifth year player, but don't really need him in 26, 27, 28, that's fine too. You can have guys on different developmental tracks. So I would, especially in the new 95 scholarship era, if that's kind of what Notre Dame's going for, I would always sign an extra offensive lineman, an extra defensive lineman, an extra defensive back, and an extra wide receiver. So Charlie Tom is your extra offensive lineman.
Good point. And, you know, I mean, Billy Shrouth could leave as well after this year.
Yeah, you never used to consider that. Now I actually went back at a poster who was in my Monday musings, I tried to do a look at some key points for trying to go to a national title, 24, 25 versus 26. And I ranked 25 as the best offensive line year, assuming people are going to leave, because I never would assume that these guys, I would say, like, why would Charles Jagasa go pro as a junior? Would Billy Shrouth can't go pro yet? But now I think some of those four guys that can leave will have good years and go to the NFL. Yeah. It's just the new reality.
As you guys are talking, I'm thinking other guys that, you know, Emil Wagner has 2 years of eligibility.
There's four. Ashton Craig, if he has a great year, right. He's been hurt. Why not leave? Why not?
Yeah.
If he's going to be would, a good man. Projection.
Yeah, you could lose a pretty good cross section of that group, and that would put a different slant on things, certainly.
Well, I know we haven't looked at much Sean Kraft for the 2027 long snapping, but I did have a quick conversation with Eric on this and made a good point, because I just did a Joseph Vinci piece where I realized I had never spoken with Joseph Vinci. So I did a lot of research and watched him on a couple of podcasts with his old high school, Tim Priester. That was illuminating. So that's how I got to write about him. He's a big guy. He's 6'4", 230. The first thing they said about him on this podcast from his high school is, we're used to seeing you running down the field and hitting people. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I have never known that about him. But Sean Kraft is also 6'4 and already about 215. In other words, Notre Dame has a plan at long snapper, and it is not to have big defensive linemen stepping over their snapper again to block kicks.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, we all thought it was unusual when Reno Monteforte won the job, and credit to him. I mean, what a tough little dude. Yeah, and, yeah. You know, I mean, but he had limitations. And
yeah, little dude, as you accurately described.
Exactly. And so, you know, give him credit for working as hard as he did and putting himself in position. Yeah. Where did he transfer to? I don't
Cal.
Even remember.
Oh, yeah. Transfer to Cal. And actually, so. And on topic, since we don't talk about long snappers much, Vinci actually said, because Vinci took his job, basically, in week 8, right? Yeah, week 8, because he's still all, he actually redshirted, but played 8 games, Joseph Vinci, as you put
that
in
is
alert,
a, yeah.
Meister. Yeah.
That's a modern day, play 4 regular season games. He didn't play against Army, obviously, on purpose.
On purpose, so he could be there for USC, yeah.
And the 4 playoff games don't count, so he played 8 games. He's still a freshman eligibility-wise.
He credited Monteforte in every interview with...
fantastic, great.
Giving, I mean, still teaching him when he lost his job to him, which is kind of what you want from your specialist and walk-on crew. This is not this weekend, but I didn't want to leave recruiting on a long snapper note, so next weekend, 4th of July, there should be, I believe... three, maybe not Notre Dame, but 3 decisions in a row coming from Kadon Finley, Devin Fitzgerald, and Braden Robinson. Obviously getting 2 of those 3 would be fantastic. Some stuff, I guess Notre Dame trended up a little bit more, Pete, than if we would have done this podcast before their official visit weekend.
Yeah, I would qualify that 2 out of 3 would be fine as long as one was Kadon Finley.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
2 out of 3 and one was not Kadon Finley, I wouldn't consider that.
I've said it in a previous podcast, I'll take 1 out of 3.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, that's the one.
I think we had this conversation about like 2 at once before. Do you want 3 prospects or I want Stephon Tuitt?
I mean, it goes back to where Charlie Tom, like, if you're going to sign 5 wide receivers in this era, great. I mean, One of these guys is the extra guy. They're all not going to work out. That's how the world works. But they can't work out if they're not on your roster to begin with. So get as many on your roster as you can.
So
I mean, that's the reality. We've talked about this many times. That's the reality today, that, you know, the old, when you get a scholarship from Notre Dame, it's good for 4 years. They can't do that. And you just can't make that promise anymore and still continue to, you know, compete for playoff spots, et cetera. So that's just going to be the reality moving forward, that if you bring in extra guys, so be it. The ones that can't contribute will fall by the wayside. And that's just part of the process now.
If you sign a group of three, well, one of them's Jaden Greyhouse, one of them's Rico Flores, one of them's Braylon James.
Good. Yeah.
And then the walk-on is Jordan Faison. So like you just... I think wide receiver is probably one of the bigger crapshoot positions in terms of who actually works out.
Oh, so, I definitely agree with you.
Yeah. So to have an extra roll of the dice here, I think it makes sense as from a roster management point, especially in 2025, to do that.
I think it used to be, I mean, I know it used to be quarterback was a crapshoot. I think it's gotten better, actually, quarterback identification and recruiting, at least what it was when I did a study like from maybe 08 to 18, where nationally you could just look at the top 10 composite quarterbacks and go hit, miss, 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 transfer, 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 hit. And I don't think it's like that anymore. If we go down, this would be bad radio, but if we go down the list, I bet you'd find more hits in the last 10 years identified there. Wide receivers, man. Maybe it's because we say things like there's 150 DeVaris Daniels. There's also 400 guys that are 4 stars that maybe can't play wide receiver at the college level, but they sure are good athletes. I think that it might work both ways at that position.
When you say bad radio, Tim, is that when everybody takes a shot?
Yeah, it's the one. That's why I throw it in there. Yeah, I'm going to work Joe Burrow in for Pete. He's here this week. So
yeah. Yeah, I was going up the 2023 guys going into their junior year of the top 10 quarterbacks. Arch Manning is 1, Nico Amiava 2, Dante Moore 3. I think you'd have to say hit on those guys, even if their paths around have been weird. But then you got Jackson Arnold transferred, Malachi Nelson, huge bust. Jaden Rashada goes without saying. Aiden Childs has been good, now at Michigan State from Oregon State. Hmm. Austin Mack, I think he's stuck with Washington or maybe transferred out. And then Avery Johnson is good. And then Vezina was number 10, who hasn't really had a shot at Clemson. So 5 out of 10, actually, I would say is probably pretty good.
Yeah, I think it was worse. I'd like to find that old study. But
when you go back, there are some atrocious years where it's like 1 out of 10.
Wow. I wonder if Zeno contemplates his choice of colleges at this point. You know, and that happens to,
sure,
to so many kids. That, and that's why I brought up Vallejo the other day. You think Vallejo is thinking, I wonder if I should have chosen the other one.
Yeah. There's some off-the-field news brought to us by Football Scoop and a story written by John Bryce. You, for the first time in a quarter century, is that right, guys? Dave Poloquin, the current assistant athletics director in charge of strategic initiatives, has taken a new job. He will be joining Athletes First, and he was the better known as the director of player personnel for about 20 years at Notre Dame, director of football development at one point, and of course a Notre Dame grad. And we have worked with Dave Poloquin.
Yeah.
You guys have worked with Dave Poloquin all 25 years, and I've worked with Dave Poloquin all 17 years. So that was always good to see Dave around town, and that was a good for him and a new career move and a new path.
Yeah, a real key behind-the-scenes guy for Notre Dame that a lot of people on the outside didn't know, you know, about him. He'll be joining Kyle McCarthy at Athletes First, former Notre Dame player, who's done a really good job for them. Actually, Tim, I wasn't even aware of this announcement.
I found out from Bryce. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't seen yeah, John's story, but yeah, I mean, one of those behind the scenes soldiers that did a great job for Notre Dame, that Eric Thomas was at one point when he was a student at Notre Dame.
Yeah. Dave was here as in a support role when Kyle McCarthy was a player.
Yeah.
You know, I have not covered Notre Dame football without Dave Poloquin being around.
Right.
Which I'm going to my 25th season. So that, and it's like he did everything. Like, he was the NIL contact for a while. He was sort of the de facto recruiting coordinator for a while.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
He was a student manager and retained by, I think, 5 different coaches.
Yeah, that was in the story. 5 different coaches he worked for. Could have had 6 if George would have stuck around a little longer.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you want to count him. He's just like a lot of institutional knowledge. I think, you know, regarded as a good guy. I think it's somebody on staff was texting me about him last night, just like, hey, like, you don't get this a lot. Like, this says something about Poloquin. When somebody on staff texts you, is like, hey, could you do something on Poloquin because, like, he deserves it? Like,
yeah,
guys. Like, that just doesn't happen very often. So, I mean, very, very well regarded internally, even if I think people outside the program weren't that familiar with him.
Well, he predated people knowing everybody internally inside the program, which is last 4 years because of general managers and NIL and all that stuff. Like, that wasn't, you wouldn't be able to name the director or the player development director at Notre Dame other than us and writers that Daily Beat media writers would be able to name him. Now everybody can name who's the general manager at Notre Dame, and that person didn't.
Well, now everybody has an opinion about every support staff person that's hired. You know, you look
how
at
in the world
look
do
at their,
know how they're doing.
Right, you look at their bio, and you know you don't have a whole lot of information. You just have to trust it. But I mean, everything you guys are saying is correct. And we have, in years past, Irish Illustrated has featured Dave Poloquin, and good guy, Notre Dame guy, unsung hero along the way for Notre Dame football.
Couple of thoughts before we wrap up segment one. It was National Notre Dame Updates Its Weight Day on Monday. Pete, do you have any thoughts on that? Is there anyone out there? Is there an Anthony Vernaglia in this group that you think had the best summer of his life so far?
No, I know people love that Kedron Young is 241 pounds. I'm not sure how many carries Kedron Young will get with Jeremiah Love, Jadarian Price, and Aeneas Williams. Yep. But Bryce Young is huge, as we've talked about many times. So, and Christian Gray is on pace for a unanimous All-American season. Finally.
That was almost the podcast jinx, but we were able to talk about it later. So, do we get an NIL cut?
From
do Pete and I get an NIL cut out of this when he's an All-American? He's the only guy to ever be named a semifinalist for the Thorpe Award preseason after that number change. Just right away, he's a semifinalist, not even on the watch list.
I loved him in the number 29. I thought he owned it. But 6 fits him perfectly, doesn't it? I mean,
it does. 6 for 6. He could have that. That's the new thing.
Yeah.
Good.
I did follow up on your thoughts, Tim, and today's Thursday thoughts. And I thought Malachi Fields would be the two in numbers in the 80s available, or 80 and 83. I thought 80 was, I envisioned him in that number. Yeah. He's number 0.
What do you say about number 0, Tim Priester, in the past? What have you said about it?
Well, I don't like it.
It's
I would
not
never
a number,
wear
is what
it.
You said.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's not a number. It's 0. I get what it is, but some of my, okay, for me, Kedron Young, because he wasn't, what is it, 241?
241, yeah.
He wasn't quite that high in the spring, but it was brought up to me. He was like 236. It's like, is that too much? And I'm like, no, I think it fits him. So I don't think I don't think a whole lot of 241 with him. And somebody is going to have to get those short yardage runs that, I mean, certainly Jeremiah Love's very capable of doing that. Yeah. He proved that. But the short yardage runs that Riley Leonard accounted for, maybe this creates a role for him. I just want to see him at 241. I don't think it's going to look like, oh man, he's carrying too much weight. I thought he looked good at 236 or whatever it was in the spring. Tim, you mentioned, I think, a big surprise, Jared Dawson at 288.
Yeah, that one must have been intentional on his part, obviously, to drop that weight.
And, you know, he's a guy that I said, that's a two-gap interior defensive lineman. So, you know, does that mean he plays strictly three technique? You know, I don't know. I'm just interested in the combinations.
They might have him pegged as the perfect guy next to Gabriel Rubio, because Rubio's a big dude, man.
Yeah. Rubio's 322. Heinisch is only 277, but we know he can play well at that weight. Onye's 302. Mukum's 304. We've seen some summer pictures of him, and he looks frightening. Yeah. And Elijah Hughes is up to 297. So I'm really interested to see the various combinations that they have on the interior there. I have a lot of thoughts on this for Irish Illustrated subscribers. You can read it in today's Thursday Thoughts.
If this were 2007, go ahead, Pete.
I was going to say, if you're wondering what position Tyler Buckner is going to play in the fall,
that was mentioned in the story as well.
At number 26. So, I mean, like, I was told this like months ago, that he's moving to quarterback.
Wink, wink. He's wearing number 10, but
he's number 10, huh?
Listed a wide receiver, wink, wink.
There's some NIL when he ends up starting against USC, right? There's
a guy. Yeah, it's like he's not the next Chris Mitchell.
And nobody's freaking out about Emil Wagner being at 296 anymore.
I know. I actually took it out of the story, the weight story. I put in parentheses, Emil Wagner's under 300 pounds. Do you care? And I took it out because somebody would be like, what does that mean? So with Keeter Drunk, you guys are saying, Tim, this is 2007 and the two of you are doing a podcast, he would be the big machacho, right?
Charlie Weiss would name him that. Let's just see what these are all just numbers. And as I said in today's story, I mean, we'll go out to the practice field, the little amount that we're going to get to see them in preseason, and try to make a really quick assessment of how some guys look. My thought going into it is, I don't think Kedron Young is going to look like, oh, he's lacking something because he's 241. I think he carries the weight well.
And very quickly, because this is off-season fodder, but Cole Kublik and Greg McElroy named Notre Dame their number one offensive line. I know we have discussed that they are number one, two, three, somewhere along the way, but I think the news was that Texas A&M was listed at number two and Miami at number six.
I
had to be caught up on that one, right?
Yeah, and I also mentioned that today's story as well, that what I see there is four halves and nine halves not. Boise State has very good offensive line they're fourth. After that, I think there's a significant drop off. Arkansas is pretty good, but they were terrible defending their protecting their quarterback. There's some bad offensive lines on Notre Dame's schedule this year.
Pete, you like the Irish offensive line? Okay.
Yeah, it's fine. Actually, my other podcast, The Independent, I had McElroy on. We talked for 40 minutes about a bunch of stuff, but we got into Notre Dame's offensive line quite a bit. And he loved Knapp, Craig, and Wagner. And then he was like, and here's where the rich get richer.
Yes.
And then he's like, because their guard play is just like filthy. So very high on that.
How can you afford to lose Coogan, Spindler, and Pendleton? You got the best guard combination in the country.
Well, and I wouldn't say I'm going to overstate this one, but the guy that is not in the running to start because he got injured is going to impress Greg McElroy when he's on tap next year too, Kirby Lambert, because that's a player right there. Looking to upgrade your wardrobe, founded by Notre Dame alum Gal Wang, you've seen ESQ's custom clothing on the player walk and all of your favorite players and coaches. With more than a decade of making the best bespoke clothing available, ESQ will help you look and feel your best. From a perfect-fitting suit or sport coat, shirt, or bomber jacket, or that perfect tuxedo for wedding season, check out esqclothing.com and book an appointment to upgrade your wardrobe today. Mention Irish Illustrated and get 10% off your entire purchase. That's esqclothing.com. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards.
Welcome back, everybody. It's segment two, Burning Up the Boards. We start with a question from a familiar name, Keenan1W. Freeman, Marcus Freeman, has said this is an O-line, D-line driven program. We seem to have the O-line part down to a science and thankfully can avoid paying FCS tackles $1 million a year to help us. The defensive line side of it is always going to be more of a struggle to get to a championship level as a unit. Recent history suggests or seems to indicate that there's no expense spared for us to get a quarterback as we need. And in our opinion, should defensive tackle, defensive end be second in line to quarterback payments?
If the only issue I have with that, it's logically, yes. In terms of what you need to win games, the best ones seem exorbitant and would be in the NFL, where a guy like Riley Leonard has a flaw that will keep him out of the NFL and could very much help your program instead. So it's tough at corner and defensive tackle and defensive end for me, because I feel like if you're going to pay $1 million to someone, that guy probably has an option to go make 10 million.
Yeah. Or he's just like, I don't know, Tim's favorite Western Michigan transfer, like Braden Fisk from a few years ago. Like,
yeah.
Would he have helped Notre Dame? Yeah. Is he going to be the difference maker on a national championship level team? I don't think so. Jared Verse was on that team too. He is the super exception to this rule. I think it's just really hard to find those guys. Equally difficult to finding offensive linemen. Notre Dame is fortunate they recruit well enough on the O-line that they probably are never gonna have to do that. But it would be great if there was Riley Mills in the portal. There isn't. That height, weight, size, quickness combination doesn't transfer. It goes pro. So I think it is what it is. I don't think there's a solution other than just recruit better and harder on the defensive line. And then to be fair, they're doing a pretty good job of that this cycle.
What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, it's the same for me. Like, I'm not devaluing defensive line, quarterback, defensive line, offensive line, cornerback. It's just they're hard. Quarterback out of those is the only portal position, I think, that is easily identifiable. You know if he's going to be, Notre Dame knows if he's going to be a fit, and it's probably worth the money because it's also, you can't function without one. And quarterbacks going pro, they got to be obviously really good to leave early or make stupid decisions. That also happens too.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult, as you guys have said, it's very difficult to recruit great defensive tackles out of the transfer portal. I think that, like just about everything Marcus Freeman does, there'll be a greater emphasis on defensive tackle recruiting, and they'll do a better job as they move forward in the future. If you got Elijah Golden and Elster Vallejo in this class, that at least appears on paper moving forward that would solve the issue. Fortunately, Mike Mickens is still on the staff and recruiting cornerbacks. Cornerbacks would, of course, be right up there. Notre Dame doesn't have to go to the portal to get cornerbacks because they do such a tremendous job of recruiting them. But, I don't think there's an easy solution at defensive tackle other than do a better job of recruiting them. And I think that that's probably next on the checklist for Marcus Freeman, and we'll likely accomplish it like he is accomplishing most other things he puts his mind to.
Next question, Tim, you could start off with this one. Evan Martin wants to know the best Notre Dame running back duo of all time, but mostly because could Love and Price become that after this season?
Holy cow. I mean, there were guys named Bettis, Waters, and Culver on the same football team for Lou Holtz in the early 90s that were fantastic. I don't know. You guys, you, Tim, and I think fans are sometimes better, even though I've lived all of this, I think maybe better prepared to, come up with these kind of proclamations. But it's a great one. Let's see. Okay, first of all, Jadarian Price has to be more consistent in short yardage situations and can't get his mate. O'Malley's going to be charting the stuffs this year.
Don't let it happen to your pitter-patter little feet, to quote Dylan McCullough.
So however many times he gets stuffed, O'Malley's going to have the running total from week to week. So I think, for us to talk about that, he has to take the next step up. Obviously, they both have to stay healthy. I'm not really sure how Jeremiah Love's improves, other than maybe Mike Denbrock gets in the football in space a little bit more in the passing game. I don't know. But look, there was a time when Lou Holtz was recruiting running backs where they had you know, they had all American level running backs that didn't get all American recognition because you had to split those carries up. And yeah, the other ones went to the secondary and became all Americans there.
So I kind of took it as, can they perform as the best? Because like the best I saw two guys that actually performed would be Bettis and Brooks, Reggie Brooks and Bettis that year in 92.
And I didn't even mention.
Because I always look at the backfield of 1990 that you were kind of referencing. They had six deep, but like there wasn't a duo that emerged because he just brought in a bevy of backs, including Rocket, you know? So you're getting Dorsey Levens to transfer because you brought in Jerome Bettis, the freshman. You have Culver and Brooks is at corner and Clark's at corner. Like you're never going to get that again, but the two guys could, I mean, I think Bettis and Brooks are the standard for 1 year. Price and Love could come close to that. They were pretty, I mean, Bettis and Brooks were, Bettis was awesome and Brooks was better that year. Bettis might have made Brooks better, but you count what happens on the field, right?
Yeah, I will defer to the 1990s, early 90s as the best of all time. And like I think Jeremiah Love is great and Jadarian Price is really good. One guy is the NFL Hall of Fame. The other one has 10,000 yards in the NFL. So
Willie Clark's going to the NFL as a DB, and he
He played running back. They had to move him around a little bit. So yeah, it's tough. But there's another question about Jeremiah Love being a generational talent. Yeah, I think he is, actually. From CMU Pens fan, you've all said Marcus Freeman would need time as a coach to settle in, and it has now shown itself to be a positive. When in the past did you realize that it was not going to work for Davey Willingham and Weiss, and when it would work for Brian Kelly? I wanted to have Pete and Tim on this podcast for this one for sure, because you guys, at some point, covering those people, thought to yourself, that's a problem.
start us out here, Pete.
Well, I would only cover the last year of Bob Davey, so it was pretty obvious.
you were able to discern at that moment.
Yeah, it's like even 23-year-old Pete Sampson was like, I don't think this is how this is supposed to go. I heard Notre Dame football is good when I took this job. Willingham, I think even at the end of the first year, you're kind of like, this doesn't feel right. Weiss, the end of the third, and Weiss is tough because even at the end of the third year, like, okay, recruiting's coming in, Clauston's here. I think I probably was somewhere year four. I don't know what game it happened, but I sort of like excused year three. But like at the end of year four, you're just like, this is not going to work out. So was that the Syracuse year in year four?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, but it didn't go beyond that. So when would it work for Kelly? You know, if someone asked this, probably asked this question at the end of 2012, I'd be like, well, 2012. And there were some ups and downs after that, but more up. So I think probably, if I'm being honest, like, it didn't go beyond year three. You're like, okay, this is happening for this guy. Not that it happened exactly as I would have thought from there, but I would say year three for Brian Kelly, if you want to put it down to a single game, probably Oklahoma. Maybe Pittsburgh 2 weeks later.
That's how it works.
That combination of games, I thought, probably kind of told the tale on that.
The 7-day season, as Tim Priester says, right there, Oklahoma and Pittsburgh.
You know, I mean, Davey's 5 years were bad, good, bad, good, bad in that order. And so
that's tough.
Right. I mean, you don't want to start out bad. Whereas Willingham had a good year and Weiss had two good years. I didn't necessarily feel the way you did, Pete, about Willingham's first year, because I mean, obviously the offense was lacking, but the defense was really good. I've always been a proponent of Kent Bear and his 2002 defense. I thought it was outstanding, and I thought they could maintain that and then build the offense up. But I think we quickly found, I thought Tyrone Willingham was a guy that was, you know, would have offensive answers, and he didn't. Yeah. He was never a coordinator, and I think that showed.
You're right, and like I should have mentioned, because like for the same reason I thought Weiss was gonna maybe still make it after 27, Willingham's 2003 class was the class
that had all these guys.
Like, okay, this is good. I think it was when the 2004 class was being assembled, and you're like, ugh. So maybe it Let me amend that answer. I think it was probably well into 2003 before you're like, maybe this isn't going to work.
You know, and Weiss's third year was, it was just so, I mean, that team was dreadful. They were
so bad. The people trying to compare 16 to that team are not even in the room. No. You did not watch 07, if that's what you're trying to do.
The 16 team lost close games.
Yeah.
The 07 team,
they weren't good, but
you're right. You know, you're right. They weren't good, but at least they were competing. Weiss's third team didn't compete. Davey, you know, I like Bob. I considered him kind of, you know, a friend when he was defensive coordinator. Then he became head coach. And I just thought I've said this before. There were too many reasons why he couldn't succeed. I thought he leaned on those.
According to him.
And I just thought that, man, if that's your mindset, it's going to be difficult for you to be successful. And that proved to be true. Brian Kelly. I think, you know, when you lose to South Florida in the first game of year two.
When they really blew the Michigan game too.
Right. And what, there were 10 losses after two, you know, so, I mean, once they competed for the national title in 2012, well, then you think, okay, well, it's happening. It was the whole, you know, third year of the Notre Dame coach, and he didn't win the national title, but he played in it. And so, you know, I will always be a defender of Brian Kelly to the extent that he had three undefeated seasons in 12 years at regular seasons. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't happen a lot at Notre Dame. Hell, you know, I mean, Nick Saban won national titles and usually lost a game during that year. And Brian Kelly went undefeated three times. But I understand all the shortcomings and not winning the big games and not winning against ranked teams. I get all that. But I think after 2012, you felt like, okay, well, this veteran coach is going to get it and it'll start to kick in.
I was still worried about Kelly after the last time they lost to USC at home, the face plant in the 2011 game. I was like, this was a horrible effort by a Notre Dame football program. And that week is when he had the epic, and the last we ever gathered around Brian Kelly on a Thursday night, when he said, you know, you can see the guys that I recruited here. And I was like,
That's one of those.
I guess we're working the bad guys, not just transcribing.
You have a follow-up on that question?
I think I did. That's where you're trying to stuff the words back into his mouth. Yeah. Like when Marcus Freeman said, I don't even know who we play next after they beat Texas A&M.
That was the other one. Oh,
don't say that.
Yeah.
Question from, where are we, Tim?
We're at PD Halls. Often recruiting comes to closing your top targets and hopefully moving on to the NFL. As O'Malley says, if you're here for 3 years, that means they're really good. I do like to say that. I think a lot of people say that, though. With roster management being so complicated in 2025, do you think the staff purposely supplements the bottom of the class with projects that could be fourth and fifth year studs? And Pete, why don't you start us off? Because you avoided walking over this one.
I think that Brian Kelly's staff did this. I understand the roster being, they say, so complicated in 2025. Like, I think it's actually maybe a little easier because the scholarship limits are not there. You can make the portal work for you. You may lose guys at the back of your roster, but Notre Dame seems to somehow not do that. I think that getting guys on different developmental tracks is fine. Like, Preston Frizell, the tight end who committed the other week, is going to be on a different track probably than James Flanagan. Or if they get like Evan Premer, he'd be on a different track than him. So that's fine. Charlie Tom, different track than Will Black. That's fine. I think it makes sense to have guys in different. I think the way what Lauren Landau is like your training age, maybe, I think is the term he uses a little bit.
That's an interesting term.
Yeah. Develop. So like everyone's kind of on a different developmental arc. So I don't think expecting every lineman you sign in 2026 to look the same or develop at the same rate by 2029 is sort of how they don't look at it that way. They do take guys on different developmental timelines.
I definitely think, especially as it pertains to Marcus Freeman being the head coach, I think he recruits with culture in mind. I think any head coach at Notre Dame needs to be cognizant of that you have to have cultural fits. Would every head coach like to get 4 and 5 star guys? I mean, I think on the surface they would say that, but I think the reality is that you know that you need complementary pieces to the class. And when a guy like Charlie Tom comes along, it's like, that's interesting. There are some different things that we can do with him. It's kind of like Mitchell Evans. He's predominantly a quarterback in high school, and you see this big, great athlete and becomes an excellent tight end. So I don't know if they necessarily go into this with a premeditated notion that, okay, well, we're going to get guys that are three stars that, you know, can develop over time. I'm not sure if they look at it like that per se, but I think, as I said, to begin this from a cultural standpoint, I think Marcus Freeman's very cognizant of that.
And I think that it's not the three-star part. It's like, this guy is long, or this guy has,
right.
No, they got to have some weird trait where you're just like, ooh, like.
I think they recruit
that linebacker from Alabama that we signed in 2001. Like, man, he's really lanky, but maybe he could grow into defensive end. And voila, it's Justin Tuck. Like, there's got to be something developmental. Like, if they took a three-star offensive lineman who was 6'2.5", I'd be like, well, that was a mistake. Because they're
right.
That's a guy that is going to be playing in the MAC.
You're recruiting to type and trait with a long arm corner, Leonard Moore. It's easy to use this example now, but you didn't recruit the next Jaden Mickey there. You recruited someone that you thought could develop into something special.
100%.
Yeah, I think, and I hope that Bruce Heggie doesn't listen to these podcasts and hears this, but I mean, that was a different time when Brian Kelly's just trying to fill out the numbers.
Yeah.
A guy like that wouldn't be a guy like that.
I never liked that one for Heggie, because he was clearly brought on to be a practice player on both offense and defense, because he could do both, and he never thought he had to play. It was like, you do need one of those guys when you're rebuilding an entire roster. Marcus Freeman doesn't need one of those guys now.
Absolutely.
But
not.
That was that point of that was actually he was more valuable than some guys that left after 1 year. Hopefully Spencer Boyd doesn't listen to this, but there's one right there that you could just think of right away. Pete, I thought you were going to mention Jonathan Williams when you're trying to recruit an athlete.
No, I'm mentioning him.
But no, I think it's worth noting that, Priester, obviously, he would take four stars with great character and traits as well. So the star's not quite as important.
All right, we have this question for Pete from Maltese Irish. Love the stories and answers to my visit. Went great. They're definitely in the running. Recruiting visit question on Monday's pod. Would love to get Pete's response to that. The visits all went great, Pete.
It's like a family atmosphere. I could not find this guy's name. However, I know for sure he was a defensive end from Florida. I think he signed with Alabama. I was going through their commit list. I couldn't find him. So maybe he signed with Florida or something. But I remember him coming up for Irish Invasion, and his post-visit interview was like, there was no competition there. Like, nothing. No competition. And he just he was so dismissive of and I'm not saying that he was wrong, but he was so dismissive of Kelly era defensive line at that point that he was offended that they would think that he would want to go there. It was pretty funny. But I think, Mal, you mentioned T. Shepherd. He would be very high on my list too.
And you don't remember who your host was or where you went. I could see not knowing where you went. When you don't remember your host's name or what position he played, you might not be the perfect fit for that situation. From Judge Arthur Vandelay, with Nickel being the base, how do you see Chris Ash and Max Bulla allocating snaps among the four linebackers for the two spots on the field? Probably 2.5 spots on the field. But Al Golden and Bulla did an incredible job last year of allocating snaps evenly among the group. Do you see the staff continuing with the same approach in 25?
I would imagine they would. I mean, Max Bulla did we've talked about that, Tim. I don't know if you have the snap counts available, but the linebackers that were so close to one another, that can't happen by coincidence. That's a concerted effort to make sure that you're playing all your players, and you're not just playing guys to play them. It's guys that that can be effective. So, I mean, I would imagine they would continue to do something like that. I think that Jalen Sneed's a kid that if he could ever fully lock into what his capabilities are, we might see a significant jump up in snaps for him, just because he can alter the outcome of game positively in so many ways, generally off the edge or rushing Drew Eller with the game on the line late in the Orange Bowl. He was the guy that put pressure on the Christian Gray interception, right? So, I would imagine so. It was kind of stunning. If we weren't keeping track of the linebacker snaps week per week, which Tim always does, like we wouldn't have been aware that they were as close as they were, because you just, you're thinking that, well, like I was thinking, well, Jaden Osbury didn't get nearly as many snaps as everybody else, but he did.
Yeah. Yeah. It was 40. An average of snaps would be Kaiser at 40 and KVA at 28 at the bottom of a 5 linebacker list. Not even 4 then. That's
right.
That's remarkable. And Max Bulla did do it on purpose. And I'm going to walk over my forthcoming, I shouldn't say when in the countdown, Madden Foramo. I started researching that one a little bit. Max Bulla noted, I don't play them because we feel like they deserve some time. He's like, we have all good players. Okay. I don't say, oh, this guy's got talent. We got to get him reps because he has talent. Our top guys all have talent. When you have to get to a position where you're comfortable with the defense, you're communicating, commanding the defense, you're not making mental errors, you're playing at the same level or higher than the other guys, there will be no exceptions made from this. You will then be meeting the standard to get on the football field. So basically he's saying there might be 4 this time. There was 5 last time. I'm not forcing a 5th just because I had 5 last year.
They also, I mean, they blew a lot of people out last year, which like makes this easier to do. I will be very interested to sort of see if this skews heavier towards Bowen and Viliama-Asa moving forward. Because as this question notes, like it's more of a nickel game. Those are the two guys I would put on the field the most. And I would rotate a little bit less. But if you're blowing people out, I get it. Osbury is good and it's got some traits too. There are some sub packages you can work those guys in there. But I would like to see the defense have a lot of 27 and a lot of 34 out there.
I think KVA starts. I mean, I think he's a starter. I don't know, man. We know that Osbury was trained in the nickel. We know what Snead. I mean, I think that everybody around Notre Dame feels like Snead, and we're about to see the best version of Jalen Snead. I don't think you can really go wrong, but I tend to agree with just your statement, Pete, that Bowen and Viliama-Asa are the two that start and probably deserve the most reps, but the other two are so capable that
I feel like meeting the standard Bull is looking for gives a pretty big advantage to KVA and Bowen.
Yes.
And I would put Osbury next on that. KVA, I think if Kaiser wasn't on the team last year, KVA might have started quickly because you would just need his ability and talent. Yeah. Like Kaiser made everything easier for these guys. I'm not saying they're dropping off because now they've played 16 games of college football. Yep. We don't have to talk about Jack Kaiser being their leader anymore. But I feel like KVA, like it might have been like, we need KVA on the field. He's too good. He's so smart. It wasn't just his athleticism. Remember we heard in the summer, like, hey, how's he looking? They're like, oh, dude, you have no idea.
I mean, he was in a rotation before practice started July.
Yes. Yeah. It's like Christian Gray changing a number. It's the most he just shows up and it's just automatic.
We have a question from Run for Fun 1122. Which opposing player was your favorite to watch play against the Irish? It could be because you admired their ability, they caused high drama and anxiety, or simply because they were a supervillain.
Supervillain got this question asked, guys. So go ahead off that one. That's great wording.
If you want to say that Reggie Bush was all the above, that's fine. He's the best player I've ever seen in person. Like, I get it. Jeremiah Love is great. If you saw Reggie Bush in person, that was a completely different level of athlete than anybody else on the field.
Bush would be up there. I mean, you guys know my favorite, and he is nowhere near as good as Reggie Bush, but my favorite because he was just a stone cold killer that I always wanted to have play for a team you root for was Robert Woods from USC. The dude showed up, and remember when Slaughter went out in that 2011 game and we're in the press box. We weren't sitting next to each other back then. I was with Irish Ice, but Lo Wood goes out to replace him and you're standing over Robert Woods and Priester's like, Lo Wood's on Robert Woods. Does he know what's going on out there? It's just the most obvious touchdown coming. I loved his approach. He scored a touchdown on the 2012 Irish. He's the one that scored for USC in that game. And then the other guy I just admired the most was Trevor Lawrence. It was awesome.
Yeah. That was the reaction like when I saw Julian Love wasn't on the field.
Dante Vaughn. Yep.
Dante Vaughn. It was the same thing. Dante Vaughn's in. I'm going to go to the Wayback Machine. I didn't realize it when I was 7 years old, but I was in the stadium when O.J. Simpson score two touchdowns against Notre Dame in 67.
I don't see that name coming on the pod today.
So I think that, you know, when he excelled, when I was a little bit older and he was rushing for 2,000 yards in the NFL, I wasn't completely shocked by that. Anthony Davis going crazy against Notre Dame in the early 70s. Tony Dorsett ran for 300 yards against Notre Dame. 303 yards against Notre Dame.
You know, one guy, I think, Emeka Ebuka, would be really hot, would be on my list. I know he's not like flashy in terms of like his like physical measurables, but like, God, that guy was just always open.
He had over 30 catches against
the steal of the steal of the first round of the draft, Emeka Ebuka. I mean,
he just like really hurt Notre Dame.
It was such a great example of like your passing game, like you need a really good number two. They just had a first round pick as their number two, and like Notre Dame really had a hard time dealing with it. That as everybody else did too.
How about John Lynch against Notre Dame in Notre Dame Stadium?
Yeah, making Bettis fumble a couple times is tough. That was a heck of a thing. Luke Kuechly was really fun to watch.
Yeah, that's a good
against
call.
Notre Dame.
Point of the trick play.
The trick play with Searwood. Yeah, when he just ignored every aspect of it except for where the ball was going, and he ran by the flea flicker. He was awesome. I could have played with Manti. That might have made a bit longer of a tenure for Charlie Weiss if he had Manti.
Touchdown Tommy Vardell. That's a name that pops into my head.
Yeah, I didn't like that guy.
Had four against Notre Dame.
Yeah, that was no good. When I was a little kid, Tim Priester, you like this one? I loved Anthony Carter from Michigan. I love Anthony Carter. Yeah,
that was a beautiful athlete.
Speaking of Michigan, John Ryan's revenge, was that the Michigan game? We know a summer enrollee comes in each season and seemingly makes early enrollment irrelevant simply because he's that damn good. But my contention this summer is that there are five guys enrolling in the summer that might be better than the entire collection that enrolled in the spring. Am I crazy, hopeful, or simply not objective because Notre Dame beat the pants off of Georgia? That's a great finish.
I think it's a great question. I hadn't even really thought about it, but then you look at, we were naming these guys before we started recording, Dallas Golden, James Flanagan, Mark Zachary, Chris Burgess, who I'm really looking forward to seeing in Notre Dame uniform.
Speaking of the weight day was 270, right?
Yeah. Will Black, yeah, like I want to see how does he carry that? What does that mean as far as position? It's a great question because I just named five guys. I guess those are probably the five.
I'm sure those are the five. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think that there's no way that Dallas Golden's going to preserve a year of eligibility. He's too good of he's too good of an athlete. He's going to be on the field, whether it's just special teams or not. I don't know. I think there's a strong feeling around the program that James Flanagan, 6'6", 237, is going to come in and play right away too. He's not going to preserve a year. Zachary, I don't know, smaller guy, but great, great quickness. Burgess probably preserves a year of eligibility because there just won't be a need.
They need the Tim Priester eight games for Jim Kirk Burgess to preserve your eligibility, right? four in November and four
something, in run. Something like that could happen. And Will Black, one of the many really, really talented tackles/left tackles that will be in the program.
I think that John Ryan's revenge might be onto something here. Among the early enrollees, like Elijah Burris feels like a hit. I'm not sure I feel strongly about anybody else yet. And maybe we can feel strongly about these five guys because we've never seen them in a Notre Dame uniform.
That's a fun part of it.
Weird how that works.
That's a wild thing. When we do our countdown during the summer, we've seen these freshmen that came in early in the spring, and we're just guessing about these other guys based upon high school film that matters a lot, but then maybe doesn't.
I feel like, Tim, I think I put this on the board because Zachary or Cree Thomas came up. And everybody's like, you know, I thought he looked really good in the spring, and we haven't seen Zachary and Golden. Cree Thomas like muddled the waters for Zachary and Golden. I'm just saying in our countdown too, but also on the field. But like, he's already pretty good, so he's got a little bit of a leg up. But what if those guys are just that much better than he was going to be anyway? So it's almost like there's only one of them can play, unless there's injuries, that many minutes, right? Pull a Leonard Moore or something like that. So you're almost going, it's really hard to rank those guys. And as you will find out, people that read Irish Illustrated's countdown, they are kind of little more grouped together than I think they would have been if Cree Thomas did not enroll early and show well.
I mean, of those five, I think Golden Flanagan definitely use a year of eligibility.
Yeah, and Flanagan walked into a situation without the other Flanagan that presents opportunity. That really,
yeah. And that Flanagan references Flanagan. Well, we're going to be saying Flanagan with an A or Flanagan with an I.
Yeah. Our final question from jherb77, and I want to tell, I love this because it seems so insignificant, but maybe not. What is one completely insignificant thing about Notre Dame that drives you crazy? For example, my father is often infuriated by the inability to color coordinate in the stadium, a la Tennessee, Oklahoma, and most of the SEC. There are too many merchandise color options. That is a great insignificant thing to complain about. I applaud it.
Boy. Tim, you want to go first on this one?
I will, because
will.
This was,
he's got some.
This was recently mentioned in
a podcast.
I'll check
back in 20 minutes.
Well, I haven't. No, it'll be brief. It'll be brief by my standards. And we talked about this in a recent podcast, and somebody responded to it and said, I disagree. Names on the back of the uniforms. I don't care. I don't care. If fans want it, if it helps fans identify it easier, put names on the back of the uniforms. I get this one, but it isn't something that gnaws at me. The various colors of gold pants that Notre Dame has had through the years.
The mustard.
Yeah, the mustard. I guess the mustard's a little bit offensive. I get that, but I don't give a damn. I don't care. I really don't. Some uniforms are better. Some green jerseys at Notre Dame are better than others. I get that.
It's like some quarterback numbers are better than others, Pete. Go ahead.
That's true. The names on the jerseys, it doesn't bother me at all. Although you guys were talking about NIL and like the N does stand for name.
Yes, it does. So
there's something there. I don't, you know, this is very inside baseball. I don't like how we're cordoned off in like one corner of the stadium, like cows for the final 5 minutes, like
totally pointless. Yes.
It's just like, what's the point of this? Just to do it.
Keep track of them. We got to know where they are at all
right?
times.
It's just like, because I mean, the way I like to cover, like I get a ton of those last 5 minutes. Like there's a lot of good observation stuff that you're not picking up on TV, which is like what I like to write about, because if you already knew it, you don't need to read it. That would be high on my list. Other than that, man, I don't know if there's a lot. I don't know. Night games go on forever, but that's true for that's home and away. Yeah,
that's home and away. That is home and away. I've come full circle on home night games too. Now that the kids are older, I don't have to worry about that as much.
But they're not waking you up in the morning.
Yeah, it's just fine now.
It does make a difference.
Big difference. I mean, you guys know mine because I say it in the press box every single game at home. So I know I need the yelling into the mic to be part of the blue goal game only when kids are entertained by.
Talking about the in the stands reporter that is getting 6-year-olds to say,
what go Irish, hit a band.
It's the whole game. So that would be one of them. I don't care about the color thing either, but it's such a great complaint that it is funny that like Irish wear green. Do you have any green? Shouldn't you have green for God's sake? Because you're a Notre Dame fan.
Or a night game green out. You can't, it's just dark.
Yeah, the Penn State whiteout is a little cooler.
The Penn State whiteout is, oh my God, that's just classic. Congratulations to them. They can't win a recruiting battle with Notre Dame, and they can't win an Orange Bowl against them, but you got the whiteout.
On that note, that's it for today. We'll be back with another podcast on Monday before taking a one-week break for the 4th of July holiday. And I do want to point out, I'm not going to say Jack Freeman's pet peeve that I say before every home game, because I don't know if he wants it on the air, but if he wants to, he can put it on the message board. You guys might remember that. I bring it up every single time. Until then, for Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, Pete Sampson, The Athletic, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening our latest edition of Irish Illustrated Insider.